I'm Shelley Schlender for MeAndMyDiabetes.com. Many advocates of high-fiber diets say that fiber is essential for good digestive health, and that with a high-fat, low-carb diet, fiber tends to be too low. A leading rationale for advocating high-fiber diets is to feed resistant starch to the beneficial microbes in the gut so that they can make the gut cell's favorite food, which is butyric acid. But could too much butyric acid be too much of a good thing? Today, we talk with University of Toronto scientist Alberto Martin about his study that appeared in the journal Cell about gut microbes and colon cancer in mice. Martin's study indicates that mice bred to have a common form of human colon cancer get the cancer more quickly when the mice have lots of butyrate in the gut. This study was done in mice, but Alberto Martin points out that epidemiological evidence indicates that humans with this kind of genetic mutation get colon cancer more often when they eat a high-carb, more high-fiber diet. He says that about 1 in 80 North Americans gets this kind of colon cancer. Now here's Alberto Martin. Your study indicates that when it comes to someone prone to colon cancer, too much available butyrate in the gut can be too much of a good thing.
This is correct. Our data points to this. Our data argues that starting with carbohydrates, specifically those individuals harboring mutations and mismatched repair genes, a high carbohydrate diet is not a good thing. And I want to preempt everything by saying that our studies were done in mice, not in humans, so that's important to say. But there is some epidemiological evidence that a high carbohydrate diet in humans is linked to colon cancer.
Say some more about that, because there's a lot of pressure from some bloggers to say that the colon is healthier with carbs.
It all depends. We're arguing that carbs with this specific genetic mutation is not good for colon cancer. We're not saying that carbs is generally a bad thing. We're just arguing that if you have this genetic defect, you might want to reconsider taking a high carbohydrate diet. Now, it's possible, and I don't know enough about this, but it's possible that a high carbohydrate diet might be good for other things related to intestinal health. But with respect to what we're studying, it's not good. And when you think about colon cancer being, you know, one of the most prevalent cancers in the world, of those cancers, 20% of all colon cancer harbor these mutations. You know, that's a large percentage of the Western population. And so 1 in 15 of us will develop colon cancer in our lifetime. And 20% of those will develop colon cancers that harbor these types of mutations. That's about 1 in 80 North Americans will develop these types of colon cancers.
Okay, so you said 1 in 80 will develop this particular kind of mutation-prone colon cancer that the mice were certainly susceptible to when you gave them this kind of cancer. So they were sitting ducks for cancer.
Right.
Do you think it's the combination of butyrate and high insulin levels from the carbohydrates, or is it just the butyrate itself?
These studies are still ongoing. We cannot say that it's only butyrate. I mean, that would be naive to think that it's really only one element from a specific diet. It could be a combination of things. What we're arguing is that we see a correlation between butyrate levels and colon cancer. Our data suggests that it's butyrate, but we're not saying that it's only butyrate.
The medical doctor scientist who told me about this pointed out that the intestinal cells actually love to eat butyrate. They thrive on butyrate.
It's energy. It's energy for colon epithelial cells. They require this as energy, and that's their primary energy source.
His guess was that it's like too much of a good thing anywhere else, that if you feed cells more than enough, their maintenance and repair goes out the window, and instead they go into more rapid proliferation of the cells. They divide more often, which is kind of the hallmark of setting things up for cancer.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that statement. You know, like obesity is associated with cancers, right? It's the Warburg effect. So the idea is that cancers require lots of sugar. Basically, they need tons of sugar. They need tons of energy. My feel is that if you eat too much, you're going to predispose yourself to a number of types of cancers.
And one of the mechanisms is simply that if you give your cells too much available food, it overheats them into dividing more rapidly and does not exercise their maintenance and repair mode enough.
Yeah, potentially, right.
So you said one way that you cut back on the butyrate was to give metronidazole?
To kill off the bacteria that produce butyrate, yeah.
I thought that kills yeast too.
Yes, and it kills a lot of other things. It kills a lot of bacteria, right? We see major shifts in the bacterial population when we treat these mice with metronidazole. We're not suggesting that this is a good way forward to try to prevent the onset of colon cancer, because in the end, bacteria play a very important physiological role to us. Right? So that's why we're just at this point not really doing any therapeutic or preventative analysis. We're just trying to figure out how colon cancer develops in these mice. The better way forward would not be to use antibiotics because you develop antibiotic resistance ultimately too, but it's really to alter your diet.
Plus, you also mess up the healthy part of the microbiome in all kinds of unknown ways.
Right. There's very good microbiota we want to have, including the ones that we're targeting, right? Those are typically considered normal microbiota that have no physiological consequences on us except providing us with extra energy. But it's just in this genetic background, they're not a good thing. But metronidazole, it's not a smart bomb. It does wipe out a lot of different bacteria, a lot of which are probably very healthy for us.
The flip side of it is where you had the low carbohydrate diet, and when you added butyrate in specifically to the way that they ate it, and it looked like ate it and little mouse enemas, I'm not suppositories.
Well, that's a very difficult experiment because we'd have to do enemas for basically 3 weeks daily or every other day. And what we did there is assess whether, if using the enema experiment, whether we could induce this hyperproliferation that we're seeing in mismatch repairs defective cells and then correlate. And so, which is what we saw when we did the butyrate enemas, we saw that the MSH2 or the mismatch repaired defective colon epithelial cells were now hyperproliferating, and we then correlate that to colon cancer.
Thank you for explaining that you did some tissue analysis of the mice as well. Really what I was thinking of was the suppositories. And that's interesting to me because you're basically saying that when they ate the butyrate, the rest of the body metabolized it enough that it didn't ever get down into the colon in a big amount. So you had to use a suppository to increase the amount there when it was a low-carb diet. I just wanted to be clear on that because my next question is that the way that you created a diet that's low-carb for the mice, you gave them a ton of protein. It was, what, about 70% protein?
If you're going to remove carbs, you have to add something. What we have not done, for example, is, and what we're actually doing now, is asking whether a high-fat diet, so instead of having a very high-protein diet, if you have a high-fat diet, again, at the expense of carbohydrates, we also recapitulate the results, i.e., are carbs the only bad thing?
I was exactly wondering that because I'm guessing you use protein because excess protein will turn into ammonia and sugar, but your issue was more the kind of resistant carbs that end up being there in the gut, and the sugar wouldn't quite make it into the gut.
Right, sugar doesn't make it into the gut. It'll get absorbed very early on in the small intestines. The only way to deliver, let's say, sugar or energy to the colon is by providing polysaccharide, right, carbohydrate. So they can't get absorbed in the small intestine. Once they get to the colon, they get broken down by bacteria into sugars and short-chain fatty acids such as butyrate, and then they're absorbed.
The common way that gets talked about right now is resistant starches, starches that don't get broken down until they get into the colon. So when you fed protein, I mean, feeding a mouse that much protein is kind of not good for it.
Right. Yeah. And they don't like it too much. They urinate a lot. It's not a healthy diet. We're just using extremes here.
But it doesn't promote their colon cancer. Now, given what you've seen, you're curious about what a high-fat diet would do. That's a little tricky to do in mice because they don't go into ketosis unless you really are careful with it because there's that really runny high-fat mouse chow that they don't like.
When we were providing mice with tributyrin, which is 3 butyrate molecules in the food, mice don't like that because butyrate smells, right? So mice are very sensitive to smell, but they were forced to eat that. So it's not a very good experiment. But you're right, the high-fat diet might be also a very difficult experiment to do because they don't like that kind of food.
When you fed them the butyrate, how far down into the gut did the butyrate get? Was it up in the small intestine or was it in the duodenum?
In the end, what happened with butyrate is when we fed them butyrate, we were able to increase the levels of butyrate in the small intestine, but not the colon. So it didn't make it all the way down to the colon. It got absorbed before it got to the. So that's why we couldn't use that. We could see increased polyp number in the small intestine, right, which is an indication that it indeed is inducing increased colon cancer, but in the small intestine. But we couldn't carry out the experiments in the colon because the butyrate wasn't getting there.
Okay.
And so that's why we did the enema.
I mean, you were looking at colon cancer, not small intestine cancer.
We were looking at both small intestine and colon.
So the butyrate fed to the mice who were on a low-carb diet did produce polyps in the small intestine. One mechanism that this guy was talking with, he was wondering about, is that on a high-protein diet, those mice are probably fairly high in insulin. That's his guess.
Possibly. We did not.
So you have two things going. There's the insulin pathway, which will also push cells to divide and multiply faster. And then there's the mTOR pathway. I think that's a regulatory pathway target of rapamycin?
Yeah, I know what mTOR is.
Okay, and so his thought was, is the combination of pushing hard on the mTOR pathway with high protein and butyrate not so good? He was curious, too, about what would happen if it was a high-fat diet, truly high-fat, low-carb, and adequate protein. Exactly what you're thinking.
It's a very good experiment, and that's what, and we're doing that, and we really, because right now we can't distinguish the possible, or we can't argue that the high protein diet is somehow protecting mice from colon cancer. Right? It's not, has nothing to do with carbohydrates. It could be, you know, although we provide evidence that it is carbohydrates for the butyrate experiments, but we still need to test whether protein, by having more normal protein levels and increasing the fat diet and still keeping low carbohydrate diet, how does that influence colon cancer?
His speculation was that if a creature is adapted to eating a high-fat diet, then they may metabolize the fats rapidly enough that there's enough butyrate to give adequate support to the colon and the small intestine microbes, but not so much that it pushes them into overdrive. And if it keeps insulin levels down and the mTOR pathway down, there's potential for it to work.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay. He was wondering about that.
It's worth testing.
That's a good way to put it. It's worth testing, and the challenge is mice are not high-fat eaters usually. Butyrate is okay, but not too much of it.
That's what we're arguing. In this genetic background, we're arguing that a certain level of butyrate is not good. In fact, if you add more butyrate than, let's say, that's being produced with a high-carbohydrate diet using the enemas, and that, in fact, that actually has a protective effect. Because butyrate has these dual activities. At low levels of butyrate, there's more physiological concentrations of butyrate that actually acts as a pro-proliferative agent. But at very high concentrations of butyrate, it acts as an HDAC inhibitor, so it's a histone deacetylase inhibitor, and actually it inhibits proliferation.
Very high levels of butyrate inhibit proliferation?
Yeah, that's a known effect. It acts very differently at very high concentrations. It inhibits these enzymes called histone deacetylases. So that's what they call histone deacetylase inhibitor. And by inhibiting histone deacetylase, it basically promotes a reduction in proliferation.
And does that mean that it also promotes more maintenance and repair when it's super high?
When you say repair, what do you mean by repair?
Cells kind of are in two modes. They're either conserving their resources and fixing up their shop to hunker down and live through a fast. So they're going into maintenance and repair. Or they're saying, gee, there's lots of energy around right now, time to multiply and divide. I've always thought of them as flip sides of a coin.
Yeah, and they could be. I don't know enough about cellular physiology in the colon with respect to repair and how pathways that induce repair versus pathways that induce replication, how they interact. I don't know enough about that.
Okay, but in these mice, one reason you gave them the suppositories was to see what ultra-high levels of butyrate would do.
At very high levels of butyrate, we actually saw a reduction in proliferation, but at more physiological levels of butyrate, we saw an increase in proliferation. So we saw like this bimodal effect of butyrate.
So you think it's because that switched the pathway once again?
Yeah, very high levels, it acts differently. Butyrate no longer acts as an energy source. It starts acting, in addition to an energy source, it starts acting as a modulator of gene transcription by inhibiting histone deacetylase.
I didn't know that. Some of the gut microbe researchers for conditions such as autism, for instance, have told me that the issue isn't so much that there aren't enough beneficial bacteria in the gut. It's that the beneficial microbes keep the bad bullies in check.
That's the common thinking, yes.
I can't tell when you said that whether you agree with the common thinking or not.
So I think it's the current thinking. I don't think any of us are in a position to say that is correct or incorrect. I think that is currently probably accurate, that we do need a microbiota there to basically keep, say, the bad guys out. But, you know, microbiota research is still in the early days, so we're still learning about how microbiota influences other bacterial colonies. But you know, like the term dysbiosis, you know, when we have dysbiotic microbiota, we see an increase in, let's say, pathogenic microbes. Is that due to a loss of non-pathogenic microbes or commensals that we call? So we're still learning a lot about this interaction, interplay between different bacterial species, the communities that they establish in the colon and the small intestine. Really try to understand how these communities function together and let's say, keep other bacterial in check. But I think what that statement is currently, I'd say, accurate, but it's still early days.
the article I'm going to write is going to focus mostly on high fat and the microbiome, because in the blogging community, there's such a rift between thinking whether that's good or bad. And you, as a researcher, I hear you saying, really, the jury's out. We don't know.
I think we have bits of evidence. I shouldn't say we don't know in certain cases. We have bits of the puzzle are starting to form, and that's why that statement is probably accurate, but it's still not fully, you know, we still haven't completed the puzzle, right? So there can be surprises.
You did a low-carb, high-protein diet, which is not the same as a low-carb, high-fat diet. And a high-fat diet for mice is often that basically half-sugar, half-lard diet. So there's definition that needs to get clarified there. One researcher said to me, well, when you're feeding the carb microbes, you feed both the ones that are beneficial and the ones that are not. But it's kind of like there's enough of the beneficial ones. As long as they're being fed, they keep the bad guys in check. But if you stop feeding them carbs, then they start to eat the intestinal wall because you're not giving them the tribute they need.
Yeah, but then those bacteria might also decrease things. And we see major shifts in bacterial communities when you reduce or change diets and reduce the carbohydrate intake. Those bacteria that require carbohydrates, they will slowly disappear. If not fully disappear, they will be reduced in numbers.
How many days or weeks do you think a body needs for a shift of diet to actually measure it?
I think it's pretty quick. And when I say pretty quick, based on our studies, I think 1 week is sufficient to see measurable changes in the gut microbiota. For example, you cut carbs. 1 week later, you will see measurable differences. I'm not sure whether you hit the baseline after 1 week. It might be a bit more before you hit a baseline that's steady. So if you continue eating a low-carb diet, well, you hit a baseline 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. I'm not exactly sure, but I know that you can start measuring differences in microbiota with a 1 week shift in diet.
If people were going to do this, like through the American Gut Project, a week would be enough, but 2 weeks might be a little better.
Yeah, I would argue that the jury is out on that because I think people are currently doing these types of studies, but I don't think they've done them systematically at the time. But I think those are good questions. Those are good questions to test. You know, and different diets are going to likely lead to different changes in the microbiota and at different rates and with different baselines. So it might take, if you have a high-fat diet, it might take longer to see visualized changes. And the baseline might take even longer or shorter. I don't know. There might be some scientists, I should add, that are really already testing this and have already tested this. And I'm just, at this point, a bit unaware of their data. And poop samples is one thing. But the bacteria that reside along the mucosal surface of the intestine and the colon is different from what that comes out in the poop. They're different.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, the bacteria that reside along the mucus interface so there's more oxygen right lining the tissue that lines the gut, right? Because that's where the oxygen comes from, the cells. And so the bacteria that reside there are more oxygen resistant than those that exist further into the lumen. Those tend to be more what are called obligate anaerobes.
Yeah, so they're anaerobes, but the ones that you're most interested in are the ones that get to snuggle in right next to the intestinal lining where there actually is oxygen.
There's a bit of oxygen, yes. It's not as low as it would be slightly further into the lumen. And so the types of bacteria that exist in the poop is actually quite different from the bacteria that exist closely associated to the tissue. Again, that's why we're still in early days. Just using poop analysis to measure effects on diet and bacterial composition is just one variable. But really, you might, if you want to be more complete, you want to combine the poop analysis versus the mucosally associated bacteria.
What's making the butyrate? Is it everything in there, or is it the ones that are snuggled right next to the intestinal lining?
It's the either one. So typically the ones that are, and this is a recent paper that just came up by Gary Wu, but he shows that the bacteria that basically are the metabolized carbohydrates are found more into the lumen, so further away from the mucosa.
Okay, so they're providing the food that the intestinal lining loves to thrive on, but the ones right next to the intestinal lining, they may be either promoting health of the lining or aggravating it.
Yeah. Again, early days, yes.
I'm Shelley Schlender. We've been talking with Alberto Martin of the University of Toronto. You can find more interviews like this at meandmydiabetes.com.